I'm John Krall. Coming up on No Limits, we will mark the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Rides, that seminal set of events that helped transform both the civil rights movement and America. We will talk with Hank Thomas, one of the original Freedom Riders, Wilma Moore of the Indiana Historical Society, and Zach Rooker, a 17-year-old high school student from Warsaw, Indiana, who has done an amazing documentary on the Freedom Rides. And, of course, you. You can join the discussion by calling us toll-free at 1-866-476-3881, emailing us at nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending comments or questions via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Please do join this conversation about one of the most important moments and movements in American history. First, this news.
If your intent is not to be a bona fide interstate passenger on a bus, why don't you just stay home and mind your own business and everything will be all right.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking today about the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Riders. We're fortunate to have as our guest Hank Thomas, one of the original Freedom Riders, on the phone from his home in Atlanta. Hank, how are you doing? Hank? We'll see if we can resolve that. We also are fortunate to have as our guest here in the studio Zach Rooker, a 17-year-old Warsaw Community High School student who's done a remarkable documentary on the Freedom Rides. Zach, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. And Wilma Moore, the archivist in African-American history for the Indiana Historical Society. Wilma, thank you for joining the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I am gathering, Hank, are you with us now?
Yes.
Oh, good to have
you with us.
Thank you for joining the program. I'm going to ask on this so that we've got a context. I'm going to ask Wilma to kind of set the table for us and talk really about the, you know, the historic significance of the Freedom Rides. Why were they such an important event or set of events in American history? Why are we still talking about them and celebrating them 50 years after the fact?
The Freedom Riders are such an important part of the civil rights picture. When we look at it, we think in terms of the time period. There were Freedom Rides earlier than 1961, but certainly the main Freedom Rides occurred in 1961 when a group of people who were everyday people, but essentially civil rights activists, rode interstate buses to challenge the 1960 Supreme Court decision, Boynton versus Virginia, which basically said that segregation was outlawed in restaurants and terminal waiting rooms. And the reason why the interstate travel was so important as it relates to the United States is that it affected so many people. And it was just a small part of public accommodations, which is really, which really defines civil rights when you talk about everyday people. And
though, well, it speaks powerfully to the human freedom to move. Freedom of movement is a pretty powerful human spirit or human element.
Certainly. And it has such consequences for not only those people who were riding the buses in the segregated South, but also the people in the North who were very much connected to those people in the segregated South. Because when we talk about African Americans and looking at migration patterns, especially people coming to Indiana and to the North, these are folks who certainly up until the until post-Civil War Reconstruction period, the majority of those people lived in the South.
Mm-hmm.
So you have people coming to the North. So not only are you talking about the people who are riding in the South or throughout the South, but when we talk about interstate travel, we're talking about people who are going to have reason to go back South. And for those people who are living in the North and who go back south, you want to be able to feel like you can at least maintain your standard of living. And if you're not riding in segregated buses or modes of transportation in the north, why would you want to go back south and do that? Or why would you want to feel your family and friends had to endure that? So that was just such an important part of public accommodation. And as you suggest, John, the whole issue of the freedom of movement.
Well, and Hank, I'd like to, since you are the primary source here, you're the one who lived through this period. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, what prompted you to become a freedom rider? What your motivation was? Sort of explain where you were in your life at that point.
I answer that particular question this way. Let's just say I was 19 years old then, but if I was 19 years old back in 1862, I would have been a member of the Massachusetts 54th Colored Regiment. And if I was 19 years old in 1942, I would have been a Tuskegee Airman. So, as far as I'm concerned, in my DNA, was that of being a fighter, a warrior, and a rebel. Growing up in the South, I saw every day the contradiction of what I studied in the textbook about what America is all about, a land of liberty, freedom, and justice. And I witnessed every day that contradiction. I think probably by the time I was in the sixth grade, I stopped pledging allegiance to the flag because the words of it were a lie as they applied to me. So when the time came, as I was a student at Howard University in 1960, and when the four students at North Carolina A&T first sat at the lunch counter in our first battle to dismantle this apartheid system, I didn't need to wait a minute longer to get involved, because all of us throughout the South were waiting for this particular moment. So it wasn't any kind of pull on the road to Damascus type of experience that I had. I had always been waiting for this particular moment.
So, Hank, it is as if there was an opportunity that presented itself to put your beliefs into action then.
That is correct.
Well, what part of the South did you grow up in?
I grew up in Florida, but I spent a little part of my life in Georgia, middle Georgia, and as I look back on it, that was a very, very mean part of the country insofar as white attitudes and action toward black people. As we used to say back then, my parents would say, white people were just plain mean to black people in that section of the country. And then in St. Augustine, where they were not that vicious, but you still had the system of segregation, that's St. Augustine, Florida.
Well, let me ask Hank one more question here. When you say after basically the lunch counter demonstration in North Carolina, that you saw that there was a way to put your beliefs into action, how did you go about saying, yeah, I want to be a freedom rider? Could you walk me through that progression, how you went from being someone who had a concern to being someone who was taking action?
Well, remember now, in 1960, which was the year before then, I had already been arrested for sitting in at the lunch counter in Hyattsville, Maryland, right outside of Washington, D.C. When the Congress of Racial Equality Corps, the sponsor of the Freedom Ride, sent out a call to ask for volunteers, and I think they sent the call out to colleges where the students had been active. So once again, I volunteered, and that was just the next step, if you will, in my journey to becoming a full-time activist and warrior in this cause to dismantle the apartheid system in this country. So once again, it didn't take much. It was just that opportunity came along.
I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Zach Rooker, you're sort of the outlier here in that not to out the other folks, but you're considerably younger than everyone else on this program. As a 17-year-old high school student, you've done this documentary on the Freedom Rides, remarkable piece of work. And you're a high school student from Warsaw, Indiana. Could you talk to us a little bit about what prompted you to do the documentary in the first place and why the Freedom Ride spoke to you so powerfully?
3 years ago, in eighth grade, I was participating in a great program, National History Day, where I created a documentary that was 10 minutes long on one topic in history. So I traveled through the South because I knew that I wanted to do a topic on the civil rights, some civil rights history for my documentary. I took a two-week tour through the South to places such as Nashville, Birmingham, Montgomery, Anniston, Alabama, where the Freedom Rider bus was burned. And I learned of the Freedom Rider story. I was really captivated by the story of people like Mr. Thomas, who was 19, 2 years older than I am now, or Charles Person, who was 17, the same age as I am. These people were willing to put their lives on the line for this. That was something that I had never really thought about doing before. It really struck me. So I read as much as I could. I became very interested in the Freedom Rides that year.
Well, and how did you go about in terms of – you do interviews with participants in the documentary, with people who participated in the Freedom Rides. How did you go about selecting – who you were going to interview, and then there's a certain amount of work in finding these people and actually going to do the interview.
Finding them was actually relatively easy. Mm-hmm. I read Raymond Arsenault's book, Freedom Riders, the biggest book that I could find on the Freedom Rides. In the back, it actually has an index of people who were involved in the Freedom Rides. It gives a short bio about them. But it also tells what happened after they were involved in the Freedom Rides and where they live now. So I was able to find out where Mr. Thomas lived, and I contacted him on the telephone, asked him for an interview, and thankfully he said yes. So I was able to travel around that year getting interviews from people in all different parts of the country.
And how long did it take you to do this? I mean, was it... In terms of the travel, did you try to do it all in another two-week period and just do one interview after another, or weekend trips, or what?
They were really weekend trips that I did, but this process takes me from the beginning of June in the summer to June of the next year when the national competition is. So it's a long process.
And what would you say is the lasting lesson that you took from the work that you did?
For me, for a young person, the lasting lesson is that my voice can be heard. Oftentimes, it seems like adults aren't listening to young people, but these Freedom Riders showed me that my voice can be heard. I can speak out for what I believe in very powerful ways.
So it, in addition to obviously being, you know, a transformational experience in terms of America's racial history, it was also to some degree one for you in terms of generational history. We are talking about the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Rides here on No Limits. I'm John Kroll. We're fortunate to have as our guests Hank Thomas, Zach Rooker, and Wilma Moore. Please stay with us.
we accepted the advice from our Southern friends that we would stick to the Upper South, where perhaps there would not be as violent a response as there might be in Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana. We did not, at that time, bring a great change in, but maybe we pointed a direction. And that was as much as I think we could hope for.
Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking today about the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Riders. And our guests are Hank Thomas, an original Freedom Rider, who's on the phone from his home in Atlanta, Zach Rooker, 17-year-old Warsaw Community High School student, who's done a documentary on the Freedom Rides, and Wilma Moore, the Indiana Historical Society, who is an archivist in African-American history. I'd like to invite our listeners to join this conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending comments or questions via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Hank Thomas, I'd like to talk a little bit more about really what brought you to that moment. I mean, going into it, obviously, you said you had been looking for the opportunity. Were you aware at the time that you'd be making history, that it would be such a transformational event? And if that's the case, how did that feel?
Well, obviously, at the time, I'm 19 years old, and you don't know what the future impact will be on what you're going to do, and in terms of whether it'll be something remembered by historians. Now, true to the philosophy we held within our hearts, that we knew we were doing the right thing, and eventually the good will overcome evil. You know, I'm a student of history, and I've read about the struggles of various people who lived under oppressive regimes, and then, of course, the people of Europe who, when they were invaded by the Germans and had to endure years of oppression under the Germans, but eventually the combined forces of good, that being the Allies, overcame that. But the other thing was my seeing the contradictions and what I read in the history books and what I see the words in the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag and reading the words of Thomas Jefferson while at the same time knowing of the hypocrisy of Thomas Jefferson. And also, I've considered myself a Buffalo soldier. Let me tell you, a Buffalo soldier is any African-American who has worn the uniform, who has shouldered a rifle in the armed forces in defense of this country, enemies domestic and abroad, and then have to come off the military base, and sometimes even their own the military base, to see that contradiction. So you give your all for a country, and in the case of so many blacks who died in World War I, II, Korea, and Vietnam, and to see that contradiction, you being denied the same rights that you went on the battlefield to fight for the rights of other people. So I'm a Buffalo soldier. And so I guess you can say that at least this is the fight that I'm in on behalf of my grandfather and my father and my uncle who died in Korea, that now it's time to fight for our liberation. And that's not just hyperbole when I say that, because let's just say in Europe under the Nazis, the Frenchmen could not go in. They had to be in their homes night for the men who died in Europe to free those Frenchmen. So it was time for me now to be prepared to give my all and pay the ultimate price to free my people from the same kinds of oppression that people in Europe and that people in Asia suffered under the Germans and the Japanese.
Well, and I'm thinking we're talking about this, you know, in the broader historical perspective, and to help people understand what was going on at a much more human level. I mean, you're 19 years old, and you're traveling through hostile country. Were you scared, Hank?
Yes.
I am here. As a 19-year-old traveling through hostile country, were you frightened at any point? Appears at the moment we're having a little bit of trouble with the phone.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can. Okay. We're working on that. Zach, you said you had a point here, Zach Rooker, that you wanted to make.
During my study, what I found interesting is that people call the Freedom Riders fearless, but personally, I think that they were full of fear. John Lewis, in Walking with the Wind, relates the story of how Bull Connor, after he was arrested in Birmingham, Bull Connor takes them and drops them off in the middle of the night on the Tennessee state line.
Mm-hmm.
A few years later, three college students at Mississippi Freedom Summer, Cheney, Goodwin, and Schwerner, they're released at midnight. No one sees them ever again.
Mm-hmm.
These people are released at midnight. They are full of fear. So I believe that, yes, that they were incredibly fearful. But what makes them heroic was that they were able to overcome that fear. They were able to walk into that fear. And that is what defeated segregation.
Charles, welcome to the program. How are you doing?
I'm very well.
It's good to have you here. I understand you're calling from Indianapolis, and you've got a question for Zach.
Yes, I do.
Mm-hmm. And your question is?
I'm incredibly impressed, of course, with the freedom fighters and the fear that they overcame in their zest and desire to change the world. I was wondering, as Zach did his research, what was his impression of racism in the country, and if he has done any kind of contemporary looking around to see what the measure of racism is these days. Does he, as a young person, think that the work that the Freedom Fighters did was significant in helping to change our country?
Good question. Thank you for that, Charles. Zach?
I think it was incredibly significant in changing our country, but you know, your question was, is this segregation, or you know, what the segregation was like back then, and are these feelings here today? And I think for me, as a young person, a student, I think that there are these feelings that were present back then that I feel today in school and whatnot. Although I believe that these feelings today are being more directed towards immigrants as America becomes more closed-minded when it comes to immigration. I feel like there still is a battle that needs to be fought for civil rights today, for continuing the freedom in this country.
Wilma.
I think I can jump in.
Yeah, please, Wilma.
Here, if I can just kind of talk about that a little bit. Often I look back and I think about what has happened over the last 50 years, and which is pretty much the span of my life plus 10 years. I was 10 years old when the Freedom Riders, when the movement happened in 1961. And sometimes I think about things and I think, oh, things haven't really changed a whole lot as it relates to racism and as it relates to racial concerns. But I really have to do a reality check and go back and think about 1961. And, you know, I have to admit things have changed quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And just realizing that everything's a process. And as I go back and as I think about the Freedom Rides, I know that I watched the Oprah show when it aired or a couple of days after it aired. And Hank, I really enjoyed you on that show as well as some of the other
participants. Yeah, it was nice of Oprah to do a promo for us, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really was. And it just brought back a lot of feelings for me. As a young person, as a young African-American woman or young girl growing up in Indianapolis. And when I talk about a process and I look back at all of these things and, you know, I said at the beginning of the show that the Freedom Rides was just one small part, as was, you mentioned, Hank, the sit-ins and just so many other things. And when you bring all those things together, it really does make a difference. Or, you know, you really see what goes on. Because when I look at, say, the history of Indianapolis.
Did you grow up here?
Well, I did.
In Indianapolis?
I was born and raised in Indianapolis.
Well, and people, frankly, forget at some level that Indianapolis was a segregated city,
yeah,
too.
What I like to say about Indianapolis is it certainly had a culture of segregation. Mm-hmm. I grew up, I went to one of the quote-unquote colored schools. There were about 14 of them and went on to graduate from the black high school, Crispus Attucks High School, go Tigers. And Indiana University was my first experience of being around white students. And but when I just look at all of these things, and a lot happened between, say, 1955 with the murder of Emmett Till, mm-hmm. and say 1965, that was really a heck of a decade when you think about the civil rights activity. And I think a lot of it in terms of what changed things, because I look at specifically 1961 in Indiana and some civil rights activity going on in terms of the legislature, and then moving to 1963, and in how those 2 years things changed really tremendously when the people pretty much stayed the same. But what I attribute it to was all the national civil rights activity that was going on and the media coverage of that activity.
Well, in some ways, and I'm going to invite all three of you to jump in, but in some ways that period seemed one of triumph because there were relatively tangible goals. There were attempts to get legislation to remove legal barriers. And, you know, we're talking about significant events, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which were tremendous political and legislative achievements. But following that, the battles got to be much more cultural, economic, sociological. And therefore, defining success also got a lot harder, it would seem to me. Wilma, is that a fair assessment?
Yes, I think all of those things were going on. And you got student movement in there. Students joined in not only just, you know, before say, 65, you saw a lot of student movement in terms of the HBCUs, the historically black colleges and university. And I can remember as a young teenager having this dream of going south to school. And a large part of that was just wanting to be where the action was. I wanted to go to Spelman College, which didn't happen. I didn't have the courage to go that far away from home. But a lot of just looking at the activity and reading newspapers and watching television and everything that was going on civil rights wise, you know, I really paid attention. And a lot of other people paid attention too, and that's why the Freedom Rides are so important, and that's why we should certainly celebrate this 50th anniversary. Historically, very important.
Hank, I understand we've resolved the technical issues. How are you doing?
me. How am I doing?
Yeah, you're back. Good. Good. We're good. It's good to have you back. And I just wanted to follow up a little bit because we've had some comments and questions. We got a listener who called in and asked Zach really about the persistence of racism in American society and culture and what those manifestations are. That took us into a discussion really about the things that have changed in this country since the Freedom Rides and the things that have not. And I guess, go ahead.
Yeah, the things that have changed have been tremendous. Usually when I'm with folks and we discuss these issues, sometime I'm the odd person out. People will say things like, yes, we've come a long ways, but we have a long ways to go. I don't put that but in there. We have come a long ways. We have come light years. When President Obama was elected on that night, that was the culmination, as far as I was concerned, of all of the things that we had been trying to do, that is, remove those barriers. Let me give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
When folks want to know if the civil rights movement has been successful, I say it has been exceedingly successful, and I'll tell you why. 1960, there was no black middle class statistically in this country to speak of. We had little small pockets of black folks who had gotten a college education and were professionals, teachers, doctors, and lawyers. But insofar as having a broad-based middle class, that did not exist. So when we started to knock down the legal barriers that opened up opportunities, number one, which is education, that's the road you take to get into the middle class. And so let's say from 1965 up until 1980, you had an expansion of the black middle class that far exceeded, percentage-wise, that of any other minority group in this country, because now blacks were getting an education, and with the civil rights laws enforced against employment discrimination, so you just had blacks flooding into the middle class to the extent today that 70% of all black households or have a middle-class income or above. Home ownership, notwithstanding, you know, the blip that has happened in the last 18 months. Home ownership, equity ownership in the markets and things of this nature. It is not that uncommon to find black households with both parents having college degrees, and you have places like Prince George's County, Maryland, and DeKalb County, Atlanta, where the average black household in those county income exceed those of whites because the average educational income level exceed those. So the civil rights movement has been very, very successful. Now, is there racism? Jews are not persecuted in Germany today. Is there racism in Germany against Jews? Certainly there is. You're not going to change the hearts of all white people or the minds of all white people. And really, at this particular point, that is really not my greatest concern. The point of it is that black folks have an opportunity to get an education, to get jobs, to live where they want to live. And if you happen to be a victim of a biased white police officer, there are remedies for that in the court. So a long answer to say the civil rights movement has been very, very successful. Have we changed the hearts of everyone? No, and I don't think that will ever happen.
We are talking about the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Riders. We're fortunate to have as our guest Hank Thomas, who is one of the original Freedom Riders, Zach Rooker, 17-year-old Warsaw Community High School student, and Wilma Moore of the Indiana Historical Society. Please stay with us.
They didn't treat us like we were human. they treated us like vicious animals. Like they were always on guard, thinking that we're going to do something to them while they were doing it to us.
I did not believe in nonviolence, but it worked. We had to do it this way because we needed the sympathy of good-hearted white people who were on the fence, so to speak.
Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We're talking today about the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Rides, and our guests are Hank Thomas, one of the original Freedom Riders, who's calling in from his home in Atlanta, Zach Rooker, a 17-year-old Warsaw Community High School student who's done a documentary that is amazing about the Freedom Rides, and Wilma Moore, archivist on African-American history with the Indiana Historical Society. We've gotten a question from a listener, a tweet, and I would like to encourage our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending a comment or question via Twitter or Facebook at WFYI. Question is, asks all three of you, if you think or you're worried that as times change, this important history will not be taught. How about, Wilma, if I start with you on that one? As an archivist and a historian by training, I would think that would be of some concern to you.
Just in general, all history concerns or issues, there's always a concern that these things be documented and that they be written about and taught. It's such a process. You know, we have to collect the material, which is what we try to do at the Indiana Historical Society, have that material available for researchers, and then have people who actually come in and research. But of course, it's not enough just to research. People must write about it, and it has to be put out there. So I think as long as we can get it documented, that it's going to be there. And I guess I don't spend a whole lot of time worrying about this particular piece of history, because I think it is pretty well documented. There may be other pieces of history that I'm a little bit more concerned about.
Well, let me reshape the question just a little bit for Zach Rooker. Are there other high school students your age who have your fascination with the Freedom Rides, or are you the lonely kid who bores everybody with these stories?
That's what I find unfortunate. For me, at my high school, I'm the only one who has participated in any history competition. U.S. history is a required class for juniors, and certainly they teach the Civil Rights Movement, and the Freedom Ride story is in the textbook. But it's something that you read, you brush over in class, you take a test on, and then you forget for most of my classmates. I feel that's unfortunate, and that is why I think National History Day has been so powerful for me, because competing in that competition has gotten me so interested in the Freedom Rides and other topics of history.
Hank Thomas, go ahead, Wilma.
Let me just kind of readdress here a little bit.
Sure.
When we look back, and I was thinking about this as I was watching the show that Oprah aired about the Freedom Riders, and you think this is 50 years ago, and a lot has happened in 50 years, and it's amazing to me that, and I guess this is tied into whether or not it will be forgotten and, you know, how things will be seen, but it's amazing to me that this is history that people generally are a lot of folks don't really think about, or it's like this was 50 years ago and people don't really see it. I mean, it's like it happened, but it didn't happen. You know, people ignored, or the attitude of people today is almost as if this never happened. So, yeah, I can certainly
By this,
see,
you mean the civil rights movement?
The freedom riders and other aspects of the civil rights movement. And when I, you know, when I hear people talk about it sometimes, it's almost a denial that things were ever so bad. And so I can certainly understand the caller's question when I look at it in that vein, that people really don't realize that, yes, this did happen, and yes, it was this bad.
Well,
so,
and that was kind of Hank Thomas's jump-off point in this the place where, Hank, you started with the conversation is that, you know, the history that we have been taught, by and large, is not an accurate reflection of the American experience, at least not for all Americans. Do you worry
with reference to the history of the civil rights movement, a lot of that is going to be on our shoulders as those who were there and participated in it. We've got to write our stories, and we've got to make sure that it isn't forgotten. But let me give you a couple things that are happening that I consider bright spots.
Mm-hmm.
Incidentally, I've just come from Anniston, Alabama, where yesterday they had the commemoration of the bus burning there, and the turnout from the citizens of Anniston, black and white, mm-hmm. was absolutely tremendous, and it surprised me to no end. So the people of Anniston, and of course we're not talking about everyone, but the people of Anniston, the politicians and the business people understand, and they are embracing their history. They understand what happened then. They're not trying to hide from it. So that incident and Anniston's history is not going to be forgotten anytime soon.
What was the spirit? I'm sorry to interrupt there, but what was the spirit like at something like that? In that, you know, was it commemorative? I'm assuming it's not a celebration. How does a community say we were on the wrong side? Basically, we were on the wrong side of history.
You start out by the mayor issuing me an apology. The son of one of the men who was indicted certainly has more character than his father did. He stood up and embraced me and issued an apology on behalf of, not on behalf of, but for the actions of his father. So they are commemorating it in terms of saying that was a dark page in the history of Anniston. We're shining the light on it. We are sorry it happened. And here is a kind of a resolve that the gap between the races, or that will somehow they will make an attempt to bridge those gaps. And I see the sincerity of those folks in doing that. The state of Mississippi, that's where I'm on my way now to Jackson, because we will have the 50th anniversary celebration of the Freedom Ride May 22nd through the 26th. And I'm the national chair. I'm on my way there now, and the state of Mississippi decided last year that starting this fall, the high school curriculum will include a history of the civil rights movement in the state of Mississippi. The governor of Mississippi, Haley Barbour, almost 5 years ago, proposed, I'm pretty sure, at the urging of business people, that they build a civil rights museum in the state of Mississippi and Jackson. Now, some of the members of the state legislature balked at providing the funds for this, and Barbour got on the phone with them and told them, we got to do this because this is the right thing to do. So starting sometime in the latter part of the year, in the fall of this year, you will have a civil rights museum built illuminating the history of the civil rights struggle in Mississippi. So that will be there for a long time to come, and I'm hoping it will be the kind of civil rights museum that will be a interactive type of thing where high school kids, elementary school kids, are coming there to learn about the struggles of black folks. So I don't see the memory of the Civil Rights Museum, or Civil Rights Movement fading anytime soon, but it's going to be incumbent upon us to make sure we keep it alive. At the end of World War II, from 1945, probably for 15 years, no one talked about the Holocaust in Europe. It was the Jews who saw to it that that must not be forgotten. And so those of us blacks and whites who were involved in the Civil Rights Movement, it's incumbent upon us to make sure that history stays alive. And I think it will.
At a personal level, Hank, I'd like to ask, you know, when you look back on that time in your life, do you see that as one of the defining moments in your own life? And, you know, as we're observing this 50th anniversary, and obviously they're commemorating a lot of these events privately, how do you look back on that time? And what significance does it have for you as a human being, as a man?
I am extremely proud that I was a foot soldier in that movement. And here in Anniston, I have my daughter with me, my adult daughter, and my great-grandchild with me. And it's so important for me to have both of them with me. And later on in the year, I'm taking my entire family, and we're going to go back and revisit those places where I was arrested in the two places in the South where I was almost killed. And, you know, I am going to look back on it with pride, and I appreciate the things that my two daughters have said to me, certainly this year, about how proud they are of what I have done. I said many a times that, you know, when I sat on that front seat of that bus, I was in pursuit of my American dream. I have been enormously blessed. My wife and I enjoy a very, very comfortable living, and we are able to obviously give to our daughters a comfortable living and education, and we're able to do that for our grandchildren. So for me, I am living the American dream, and all of that has been accomplished as a result of knocking down those barriers, and the other thing is taking advantage of the opening of the gates and the lowering of the barriers by getting a good education. So what I say to young people today, do not spend a lot of time looking for racism. What I want you to do is to take advantage of the opportunities that have been afforded to you by those of us who got our heads bloodied while we were fighting racism. And I want them to take a look at the immigrants who are coming to this country, that second generation, the second generation of African immigrants, whether they're Nigerians or in the case of people coming from the Caribbean, Haitians and Jamaicans. They are taking advantage of the opportunities to get an education, and they are moving ahead, and they are enjoying the American life because they understand that this is still by far the greatest country in the world when you're talking about providing opportunities for a person to move from the bottom rung of the ladder up to the top rung, or at least the middle rung, via education. So I don't see dark clouds. I see a bright sunshine, and if there is a regret that I have, is that when I see the number of young men who drop out of school or who are dropping out of life and simply not taking advantage of the opportunities. But, you know, I'm one of those guys who will sing the loudest when I sing God Bless America in terms of being the land today of opportunities. Do we still have people who hate blacks? Of course we do. But I don't spend a lot of time worrying about them.
We've got just about a minute left, and Hank, I got to ask this question because you referenced your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren. When they ask you about that time, what do you tell them?
I have lots of pictures, and I have lots of DVDs and that I can show them, and I say to them, I was doing it so you would not have to go through what I went through. And it is only today that my two grown daughters, because prior to this, you know, they just kind of shrugged their shoulders. But let me tell you a real watershed moment for me. My oldest, my second oldest granddaughter, Gabrielle, who's 13, she was 11, she came home one day and said, "Grandpa, Grandpa, Grandpa, I saw a picture of you in my history book." And, of course, she got a book and she showed it to me, and it's that iconic picture of me on the outside of that burning bus. And she had told her classmate, "That's my grandfather. That's my grand." And, you know, they just said, "No, no, it's not." And so the next day she asked me if I would come to her school. And I went to her school, and instantly she became the most popular girl in the school because she – and then, of course, this past year – they had their Freedom Rider appreciation, and she introduced me as the speaker. Not a prepared speech, but she brought tears to my eyes when she just said, "I love my grandpa."
Oh, that is a great moment.
My grandpa.
Thank you for that story. That is a great moment. We are at the end of this program of No Limits, and I'd like to thank my guests, Hank Thomas, Wilma Moore, and Zach Rooker for joining us. Thank you all. This has been a very, very enjoyable hour. Next week, we're going to continue our anniversary themed. We're going to be talking about the 40th anniversary of the Pentagon Papers with a man behind them, Daniel Ellsberg. I am John Kroll, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism. Thank you for spending this time with us.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Radio 90.1 FM and HD1. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Jeanette Rhodes. Board Engineer, Matt Sosi, and Intern, Monica Schwab. We invite you to join us each Thursday at noon for No Limits, rebroadcast at 8 p.m., and you can listen online at WFYI.org.